welcome to Off the Page, the podcast where we take the words off the page and into your ears. As always, this episode of Off the Page will contain pieces written by the members of the Creative Writing Society at the University of Nottingham. You can visit uncws.com to find out more about the society and to visit our blog to read even more pieces by the members. So once again, welcome to Off the Page. Hi everybody, welcome to Series 2, Episode 1 of Off the Page. I'm Madeline Roach, 3-time Oscar winner. No, I'm the host of the podcast. I'm the webmaster, so I do like the emails and social media and all that fun stuff. And I'm joined here today with some lovely members of the Creative Writing Society. We have...
I'm Matt.
I'm Philippa.
I'm Ravi.
I am Catherine.
I'm Charlotte.
So we're going to read some pieces for you today, and hopefully you will enjoy them.
This is Off the Page.
So, Matthew Bird, you're going first.
Okay, so this piece was written in the Dialogue Lit Circle. The task was... What was the task?
To write some...
The task was to... Write a scene in which someone overhears a conversation and misunderstands what it's all about. And this was based on a conversation I overheard in that lit circle just before I started writing for this. Okay. "I'm going to be Jesus," the man had said at the bar. He had the height, but the hair was too short. Could that man really become Jesus? I threw a fish and a loaf of bread at him. A miracle did not happen. Had I just angered the Messiah to be? I've never read the Bible, but there's definitely something about the second coming of Christ. I thought about buying the man a glass of wine in apology for throwing food at him, but then that was silly, so I got him a tap water instead. "Treat yourself," I said to maybe Jesus, as I handed him a glass of water. He'd be able to turn it into his preferred wine, which is probably better than the rubbish the bar sold anyway. "Are you trying to poison me?" "Shit," I thought. "I'm blind?" I attempted. "Oh, I'm sorry," perhaps Jesus said. "This must be your fish and bread." He handed them back to me and placed a hand on my shoulder. Clearly, he was trying to heal me. "I can see," I celebrated. In many ways, I felt like I could actually see better. Makes sense, as I could already see, so the Messiah maybe would clearly be able to make my vision better. I threw my glasses to the floor and stomped on them in jubilation. Definitely Jesus' friend looked confused. "So, have you got the costume sorted? You going full crucifix, or..." Jesus shook his head. "No, I'm just going for sandals and some white clothes and a wig." "Oh shit," I muttered, feeling around on the floor for my glasses.
Why does the guy have fish and bread at a bar?
Just in case he bumps into Jesus.
You said that you overheard that happen, didn't
well,
you?
Well, I overheard one of the members were discussing with the people on their table at the Halloween party that they were going to go to, and he had suggested that he might go as Jesus.
Oh.
So I took that as my prompt and produced that.
That was lovely.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so the next piece is going to be by Charlotte.
So this is a submission for the blog. So you can read it alongside listening to it if you go to our blog.
Wait, you can submit to the blog?
You can submit to the blog. This is called The End of All Things, Dusk. The air was suffocating. It's too high and too cold, and Icarus is grasping at the air, hoping some hands will find him. He's deafened by the wind speed as his heart leaps into his throat. Falling, falling, falling. How could it have all come to this? Every delicate touch left bruises. Every soft-spoken word was screamed in his ear. Every look made his eyes burn. The agony was all too much, but never enough. His chest tightened as the clouds fell out of reach. There was no light here, no golden rays of warmth. His skin was raw from being scalded, burnt by every touch. The scars only surface now, at the end of it all, falling, falling, falling. The water filled his lungs. The pain of impact was white hot on his skin. His scream was stolen by the vast dark ocean. Here he was, alone. Here he was, at the end. Icarus reaches out his hands, drifting down, 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 until there was nothing.
Ooh.
We stab.
We do stab. That had got some really, really nice imagery.
I am shooketh. That's all I can say.
I really like the bit about the ocean stealing his scream.
Yeah.
I thought that was very powerful. I like the impact as he hits the water.
And you read it out very well as well.
You did. Thank you. Goodbye, little bean.
So our next piece is going to be by Philippa.
Okay, so this piece was something I started during the dialogue lit circle. There was a task where we had to write the question and the answer, and then we mixed them up and we got a different question and a different answer, and then we had to write a piece based on that. So my question and answer were, what are you doing to me? And because you're on a different planet. So I went with that. And this piece is called Evening Shift. What are you doing to me? Her image is bright but grainy on the output of the holo emitter, quivering and jumping with the fluctuations you always get when you couple an output to a quantum transmitter. Faster than light communication at the resolution of a 1960s CRT television. A real miracle. I follow the unsteady eyeline of her projection in my imagination and try to picture her looking at herself in the mirror in our bedroom, twisting and turning this way and that to see the dress that she's holding up against herself, its waistline pressed to her hip. It's a dark green in person, jade I reckon, but in the projection it's a tie-dye of pulsating turquoise black and teal. You're spoiling me, she teases, still smiling brightly. She can't take her eyes away from the image of herself, her gaze falling just behind my right shoulder. Watching herself, even through this fuzzy, twitching projection, I can't think I blame her. Only a bit, I concede with a bashful grin. I wonder what I look like to her right now. A blue-tinged mess of grease stains and static beaming into her day from the other side of the galaxy. She's all dolled up from work still. Her blazer sharp and her chocolate brown locks piled up on the back of her head in a bun that's messy but on purpose. I'm very aware that I haven't washed my hair since Tuesday, and I feel like I should apologise for inviting my form into the house like this, like my photons might leave stains on the carpet. Why? She asks, raising an eyebrow. Have you done something? Done something? I echo in mock disbelief. When have I ever done something? Can't I just do something nice? Because you're on a different planet. Because I love you. I pause a moment. Because I want to see you take your clothes off while you try it on. She laughs, but it sounds tinny over the connection, the touch of feedback that whistles through the speakers making me wince. In person, she laughs like a bell, light and clear and as easy to recall from my memory as the sound of my own voice. Yes, yes, all right. She smiles a crooked, indulgent smile and steps back out of the range of the visual input. In place of her image, my holo emitter glows with a white light, which diffuses blankly in the air, and I'm abruptly reminded that I'm actually alone in my quarters. Through the haze of light, I can see myself reflected in the grimy mirror which hangs above the wash basin next to my bed. My dirty blonde hair is cut boy short. My eyes are dark with exhaustion. I begin to protest, eyes refocusing on the spot she just disappeared from. The speakers crackle with the sound of her tutting. Don't fuss, darling, she says in that way of hers. I'm just taking my hairpin out. Do you mean pins, love? I'm not sure I quite know exactly what you're talking about, actually. Oh, well, I'm just talking about that scaffolding that keeps your hair looking so stylishly dishevelled. You know, the one which takes, what, 30 minutes to put together? But I'm sure you're talking about that nice flashy one you stick in the side at the end of it all. She doesn't dignify my teasing or the response, but the sound of a handful of pins hitting the glass top of her dressing table tinkles through the speaker like gold dust. When she finally reappears, her hair is down, falling in loose waves to just below her shoulders. The blazer comes off first, deep red and well cut to her figure. She folds it carefully in half and drops it somewhere to her side, probably over the arm of the chair tucked under her dressing table. Then comes her blouse. It's a delicate cream colour, Silk, I think, but it's hard to tell through the grain of the emitter. She didn't have it last time I was home. She crisscrosses her arms and pulls it over her head in one fluid movement, letting it drop to the floor by her feet. It stays for a moment and blinks out of existence as the visual input severs the associative bond between the element and the whole, deeming it no longer worthy of taking up bandwidth anymore. Her skirt, which matches her blazer and ends at just above her knee, comes off last. She undoes the zip at the back and sighs when it gets caught halfway down. "This is much easier when you're here," she says, cutting her losses and wriggling out of the skirt in spite of the too small waistband. "You look gorgeous," I reply. "Oh, hardly." She rolls her eyes fondly and doesn't keep away from me as I look at her. She's in her bra and knickers now, a mismatched duo of white on top and green on the bottom. The bra's well worn and simple, the straps turning grey along the edges where it touches her skin, and the knickers have a hole in the seam which runs the length of her sharp hip. "I just couldn't bear to wear anything else to the office today," she says under my gaze, adjusting her underwire and picking at the fraying edges of the hole in her knickers. "I swear I'm feeling sore already." Her hands drop down and come to hold the curve of her stomach, scarlet fingernails leaving crescent moons on her pale skin as she cradles the soft swell. She's only a few weeks along, the flat line of her abdomen barely disturbed by the embryo implanted inside of her, but it's enough to be seen, to be held. I missed the insemination just over a month ago. She went with her mum to the clinic in town and had a prepared sample of anonymously donated sperm placed into her uterus by a doctor. 2:30 on Friday, October the 5th, back on Alpha 1, late into the night rotation here on Echo S10, 3500 hours, H date 537391, a Tuesday. She didn't ring me until she'd taken a test. She didn't want to get my hopes up. When the call finally came through 10 days later, she'd taken 8 tests, and she showed them to me one by one. 8 little screens saying pregnant in plain black and white letters. It was the happiest I had ever seen her, and the galaxy of distance between us could have filled a universe and a half. "Where are you, darling?" Her crackling voice pulls me out of my memory. "Huh? You seemed elsewhere for a moment. Is everything all right?" "Yeah, no, I'm fine. Brilliant. Sorry. I was just thinking about stuff. I'm fine. Try your dress on, love. I want to know it fits." Her brow creases together in the middle, giving her painted forehead an ocean of worry lines, and her jaw clenches just a fraction, but she nods, turning away to pick the dress up again. "I won't be able to wear it for much longer," she says, as she ruffles the material up into a loose bunch in her hands. She stoops over so she can step into the skirt, pulling it up with her as she straightens up again. "Oh," she coos, as her arms slide easily into the long sleeves. "It's perfect. Can you do it up all right?" She reaches back and tugs at the zip, frowning when it won't budge. "No, don't force it, love," I warn. "You can always get your mum to do it tomorrow. Send me a picture." "No," she insists, brow creasing again. "I can get it." She's still pulling at the zipper, the fabric straining across her stomach as she tugs. "Evelyn, don't force it." "I'm not. It's fine. I just..." She stops abruptly, and her hands emerge sheepishly from behind her back. "Right." I fold my arms across my chest. "What did I say?" "I'm sorry. I'm sure I can buy a new one, a replacement." "No, you can't. I got it made. It was, you know, bespoke?" "Yes, it's bloody bespoke. You'll need to get it tailored." I sigh and pinch the bridge of my nose, squeezing my eyes closed as I do some quick mental maths. My fingers stink of oil and feel tacky against my skin. "Yeah, all right. I'll send you the money." "You don't have to send me anything. You know I have the cash. And anywho, I'm the one who broke it, so I'm the one who should pay for it." "That's not the point, is it, Evelyn?" "Then what is the point? It's a gift. It's supposed to make you happy." "Oh." She falls silent. I pull my hand away from my face and look back up at her. "Why did you buy this?" she asks. Her voice lingers heavy in the air as she smooths her hands down the front of the dress. "I don't know." "I see." Without another word, she unzips the dress and slides it off again, letting it blink out of existence as it leaves the input range, piled up on the floor. "I'll talk to you tomorrow." Her eyes don't meet mine, won't meet mine. "I don't get any call credits until next week," I reply flatly. Her mouth presses into a hard line and she exhales, loud and unsteady, through her nose. "All right, next week. Monday?" I nod. "Monday, good." She's still not looking at me. "I love you." I wince at my own measly offering, the words tasting sour like battery acid on my tongue. Yes, she says. Her gaze is slow to fall on me, sluggish, and when it finally does, she's wearing a smile that's sad and tired. Come home soon. With a shudder, her image disappears, and the room is filled with blank white light, the hollow emitter buzzing wordlessly around the dust filling its mouth. I turn it off at the wall, unplug the socket, and kick its metal body under the bed. I grab my work gloves from the nightstand, my jacket from the back of the door, and head back out into the station, 20 minutes late for the evening shift.
Oh my god.
Thank you.
That was really good. I haven't read much of your stuff.
That's because I don't
you
share
don't share
it.
Much of your stuff, but it's always a treat when
Thank
you do
you.
Share it.
Thank you. That was sad. Mm. Yeah. A little bit sad.
It's like bittersweet.
Yeah. No, that was like incredible. We stand. We really do stand. I love how when we're told to like compliment each other, we're just like, we stand.
What was the prompt again?
Prompt was the question and answer shuffle one.
When you read those out, I really didn't know where it was going, and that was so cute.
Presumably, that wasn't entirely written in the space
oh,
you
no.
had. For the
no. I literally wrote about six sentences and then was like, oh, I'll write that off. And then I actually came back to it and was like, oh,
it is nice to find that people continue lit circle pieces outside of the lit circle.
Yeah.
This is Off the Page.
So it's time for Book of the Week. This week, Ravi has brought in one of his favourite books.
Hello. So the book I've brought in is A Darker Shade of Magic by V.E. Schwab. It's the first book in a trilogy about three alternate Londons on top of our own, set in around the Georgian era. And yeah, it's exciting. Kel wore a very peculiar coat. It neither had one side, which would be conventional, nor two, which would be unexpected, but several, which was, of course, impossible. The first thing he did whenever he stepped out of one London and into another was take off the coat and turn it inside out once, or twice, or even three times, until he found the side he needed. Not all of them were fashionable, but they each served a purpose. There were ones that blended in, and ones that stood out, and one that served no purpose, but of which he was just particularly fond. So when Kel passed through the palace wall and into the anteroom, he took a moment to steady himself. It took its toll, moving between worlds, and then shrugged out of his red high-collared coat and turned it inside out, from right to left, so that it became a simple black jacket. Well, a simple black jacket elegantly lined with silver thread and adorned with two gleaming columns of silver buttons. Just because he adopted a more modest palette when he was abroad, wishing neither to offend the local royalty nor to draw attention, didn't mean he had to sacrifice style. Oh, kings, thought Kel as he fastened the buttons on the coat. He was starting to think like Rai. On the wall behind him, he could just make out the ghost's symbol made by his passage, like a footprint in sand, already fading. He'd never bothered to mark the door from this side, simply because he never went back this way. Windsor's distance from London was terribly inconvenient, considering the fact that, when travelling between worlds, Kel could only move between a place in one and the same exact place in another, which was a problem because there was no Windsor Castle a day's journey from Red London. In fact, Kel had just come through the stone wall of a courtyard belonging to a wealthy gentleman in a town called Desan. Desan was, on the whole, a very pleasant place. Windsor was not. Anyway, read V. Schwab's work and also follow her on Twitter if you have it, because it's inspirational.
So, the next piece is going to be by Catherine.
Okay, so this piece was written as part of a weekly task from my degree, which is in creative writing. And the idea was to take a setting, put someone in it that doesn't belong, and then make it sort of minimalistic, chuck a flashback in there if you're feeling fancy. And I did all of those things. So, this is called Mother's Marionette. She had been there for hours now. The tip of the steeple loomed overhead as if wanting to puncture the sky. Stained windows threw colours onto the floor, making kaleidoscopes out of pews. She looked at the shapes, thought about how she could spill paint and get the same effect. The organ hummed a single bassy note, as if refusing to be ignored. She had tried to avert her eyes from him. This man, as though born from a rag doll, had stumbled up the steps and collapsed into the altar before plunging his index finger onto one of the keys. Whether it was for stability or attention, she did not know. In his free hand, the one which, as he had shouted to the rafters, wasn't making beautiful music, was a brown glass bottle clutched to his chest. She watched him forcefully smacking it to his bristly mouth between inaudible outbursts. She thought of her dad. He had fallen over what seemed to be nothing again. "The marionette isn't to be touched, sweetheart." Her mother had closed the glass door however many inches she had pried it open, locking the case and placing the key on its top. She looked with disdain at the glass that threw her reflection back at her, mocking her. "How can a toy go untouched?" Its glossy eyes would stare at her atop its shelf, looking down at the girl that longed to make him dance. She sat there, legs crossed and expectant, waiting for the sound of her mother's footsteps to fade into the garden. She craned her neck up. Clambering to her feet, she dragged the nearest dining chair across the mottled carpet and rested its back against the cabinet side. She scanned the room for anything thick with height, building blocks for her ladder, and had soon piled phone books and magazines on top of the seat to stand on. She stretched, wobbling like the Jenga tower she had built for herself. With her small, eager hands, she wobbled the cabinet until the teeth of the key teetered over the edge and onto the floor. The door swung back soundlessly, revealing his porcelain face that was now within reach. She extended those little arms that had gotten her this far and clutched the side of his body. As he was lifted off his seat, he fell limp in her arms, his strings trailing behind him. She thought of all the games they would play, all the dances he would do. She brought him up to her face, his head just lulled on his shoulders. Her legs began to skip in triumph, ready to finally commence the playtime she'd waited for. But the strings tensed. She hadn't been paying attention. Caught in the latch of the door, they shredded themselves with every step she skipped, and in that moment, she felt the frayed fibres snap and the loose cord plummet to the ground. She dropped him. She had remembered when the man came to collect the glass cabinet, handing over a wad of 20s and dragging it to his car. Her mother boxed him up that day and didn't talk to her for weeks. She peered into his prison before it was sealed. His dull eyes looked up at the girl that had longed to make him dance. The man gripped the top of the altar and shakily brought himself up, swaying on his feet when he was finally standing. She thought about how his strings might also be broken. A marionette without a master. He collapsed and didn't move. She watched the colours.
Oh my goodness.
I think that's just the reaction, just silence and oh my goodness. Like earlier, you were like, oh, it's not poetry this time, but it still has like that nice, like poetic, like description and stuff, which was really, really nice.
Yeah, I did chuck in like with the whole kaleidoscopes out of pews thing. Like, I think I could convert this into a poem, but I think it lended itself to being just this sort of short story.
Yeah.
And the way you read often gives it like that spoken word poetry feel. Like you've got a rhythm to the piece as well as good words.
Thank you. Good words.
You did the words good.
Thanks. I wanted it to kind of be like marginally haunting as well, because there's for my dissertation I'm doing like a fairy tale inspired thing, and in my head I was like, what if this girl through her thoughts has made this man collapse, and like that sort of haunting idea behind it as well. So I think it could be partially sad and also sort of creepy. So
this is Off the Page.
So at the end of each episode, we will have a serialized piece, and the first serialized piece of series 2 is actually going to be by me, Maddie. These two pieces are connected, but like not a continuation of each other. These have both been submitted to our magazine. It's called Firelight, and you can find copies of Firelight on the university campus in Nottingham City Centre, and also online on our website, uncws.com. But yeah, so they are out there in the world, but I'm also going to read them. So the first one is called Drained. Stay, she said, reaching a small hand out to grab at a thin, pale wrist. Please. I can't. You never stay past dusk, she said as she lay hanging halfway out of the bed, the sheets draped lazily over her bare skin. Why? I can't tell you. Then stay, just this once, stay, please. The other woman, a dark figure in the dim room, turned to the other woman in the bed, stroked a delicate hand down her face in a gentle caress of affection, her eyes warm and kind momentarily. I can't, I'm sorry. But, the woman in the bed said, beginning to move out of the comfort of the warm duvet, the sheets dropping from over one shoulder to pool in her lap. She stopped, sat there, helpless, begging, beautiful. It hurt the woman's heart to leave her like this. You're tired, she said, tugging her wrist gently away. She began to move away towards the door. I'll see you soon, don't worry. And then she was gone, and the woman could only sigh and fall back into her bed, wrapping the sheets around her cold body, rocking with little shakes of misery and confusion. You need to stop, Lilith, a voice said as the thin figure left the apartment complex and entered the derelict street. You're only going to kill her. Lilith stopped, sighed. She turned to the voice, an unusual acquaintance of hers, a werewolf she had met before, a long, long time ago. I know, she began walking away. Then why are you doing this? The werewolf shouted, following her in hurried steps. She will die and you'll hate yourself for the rest of your days, and you've got a long time till the end. Lilith stopped again and turned to face the werewolf, her tear-filled eyes reflecting the light of the half-moon. This was never meant to happen. Her beautiful face twisted into a look of pain, eyebrows drawn into a delicate frown and plump lips downturned into a thin line. She was still enchantingly attractive, even with a breaking heart. I love her. Lilith, you're a succubus. You can't love. I know. I can't love. I can only fuck and kill. I know. There were cold tears trailing down her cheeks now. But what I feel for her is love. All the years I've lived without her are memoryless, and all the years I will live without her, I will be haunted by the echoes of our time together. There is nothing within my head but her. She will die, I know, and I will kill her because I can't bear to leave her, to break her heart without an explanation. Then explain. And how would I do that? She cried, throwing her hands up in frustration. Hey, baby, by the way, I'm a succubus, and the more I'm with you, the more I'm killing you. I've ruined you, and now I'm leaving you just to live a little longer, alone and miserable, until you die because of the damage I've done loving you. She lives in the suburbs. If she's not used to demons and witches and fairies, then she's living with her head in the clouds. Just tell her before you can't anymore. There was a pause as gentle wind weaved through Lilith's hair and stroked the tears away. She found her voice, though small and weak. But she'll hate me. And I can't have that. I'd rather her love me and me hate myself. It's easier that way. Less painful for her.
I would die for them.
Right? Yeah. Oh, she's gonna so bad.
Yeah.
Please let them be happy.
You're gonna hear the second part next episode, and
I still remember the first time you read that in the Light Circle.
It's like fucking
I remember like most of that piece.
I don't even remember reading it in the Light Circle.
How much of an impact.
I think that was one of the first ones I went to as well.
And then I remember reading that and I'm like,
that's why Catherine came back.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I think it was urban fantasy that I wrote in.
Your reading makes it a lot more emotional as well, because you're on the verge of tears, we're on the verge of tears, your characters are on the verge of tears.
So good at the voices, I was like picturing the whole scene in my head, and I was like, I'm gonna cry.
So that's the end of this episode of Off the Page. Thank you so much for listening. I really hope you've enjoyed it. Check out the links in our description for our SU page, social medias, and the blog. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. Go on, Charlotte.
Aww.